It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, terrorist attacks involving vehicles have struck cities around the world, and preventing them can be a challenge. We'll hear how short, sturdy posts called bollards could help provide a solution.
First, the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents voted yesterday to officially merge two-year colleges in the UW system with larger four-year campuses.
According to System President Ray Cross and the regents who voted in support, the move is a way to streamline the system and reduce costs. But critics say the decision was made too quickly and that there wasn't enough input from administrators and students at the two-year schools.
Rich Kramer is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Eau Claire and has been covering the regents' meeting. Rich, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So how did the vote come out in the end?
The vote was 16-2, 16 in favor, 2 against. It was Tony Evers, who's a regent, basically because he is the state's superintendent of public schools, and it was also Regent Mueller who voted against it, saying that she was a little uneasy with the speed of which it was happening before actually being able to look through supporting documents.
And what was Tony Evers' reason for voting against it?
Pretty much the same thing, going too fast, because the proposal came out about 30 days ago, just less than a month, and a lot of the stakeholders felt like they were not included in the process. They didn't even know about it until the week that it was announced, so they felt left out. They wanted more time. But President Cross and other regents said there is no time.
And so what are the reasons that President Cross and others are giving for creating this merger plan?
Well, it has to do with enrollment. Since 2010, the enrollment at UW colleges, and again, we're talking about the two-year campuses that are mostly in rural areas around the state. There's 13 of them. Enrollment has declined overall by 32% between 2010 and present day. At some schools, like Marathon County, UW-Marathon County, it was as much as 50%. And these days, with state support for public higher education declining over the past 20-plus years, the tuition dollars are especially important. So President Cross basically said that the reserves just wouldn't cover it, you know, so they had to make a decision very fast. The other thing that they point out is that the demographic trends show that we as a state are getting older, fewer high school kids that are getting towards the age of college. I mean, that age group is projected to grow by less than 0.5% over the next 20 plus years.
Did President Cross lay out what the future would be for those two-year colleges if this merger didn't happen?
Well, the word closure was thrown around quite a bit. And, you know, Chancellor Sandeen, who is the chancellor of UW Colleges and UW Extension, as we know it today, she was blindsided by this whole actual formal proposal, but also she knew this was coming. She knew that these enrollment trends and demographics didn't bode well for the colleges. They seem to be taking the brunt of the impact first, I guess.
So how is it being decided which campuses would be absorbed by which four-year colleges? Is it based solely on geography, or how are they kind of pairing them up?
Well, it's complicated, and it seems to be kind of a case-by-case example. For example, UW-Barron County is located in Rice Lake, about an hour north of where I'm sitting. That is actually, traditionally, it was created as a branch campus for UW-Stout in Menominee, but that campus in Barron County is being merged with UW-Eau Claire. The question was asked during the regents meeting, why not go back to Stout? Well, President Cross mentioned in that specific case that there's more students that transfer from Barron County to Eau Claire. Also, some of the mission, the mission seemed to align better.
So other than the concern that this is happening quickly, that there wasn't enough time for input from stakeholders, are there other arguments or opposition to this merger?
Well, one thing that came up a little bit, not just during the meeting, but some have kind of taken issue with the enrollment numbers, the decline that they're talking about, because they say it's misleading. If you look at the trend ever since the UW system kept records, 2010 was like a record year for enrollment at a lot of these schools, and in general, it was just a lot of students. So they're saying if you're comparing current enrollment figures with a record year, it's kind of a skewed view.
We're talking with Rich Kramer right now. He's a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire, and he's been covering the Regents meeting that ended yesterday with a vote in favor of merging two-year and four-year campuses. So, Rich, you spoke with some students about this plan and their reactions. What did they have to say?
Yeah, I spoke with the president of the Stout Student Government Association, and this was a week out before the Regents voted. And at the time, there was a lot of mistrust, kind of suspicions that this was politically motivated, that perhaps it was some kind of a deal that Regents had struck with lawmakers in order to get better budgets. But really, if I were to boil it down, I would say it was just frustration for being left out completely and being taken by surprise when President Cross announced his plan on the 11th, I believe it was.
And some proponents have said that this will actually offer students a wider range of classes that they can take. They'll be able to access more resources on these larger campuses. Do you have a sense of whether students are kind of believing that or thinking that might actually come out in their favor?
Well, the main opposition that I saw to this, that I kept hearing about, was just the fact that it went so quick and that the stakeholders weren't involved prior to. Pretty much everybody I talked to said they didn't oppose the plan itself, but they just didn't like the way it came about. It felt rushed. So there are a lot of people that are excited up in Barron County about possibilities at UW-Barron County, which would become a branch campus of UW-Eau Claire, as I mentioned. The idea that right now you can get associate's degrees right there, but you're not able to get your bachelor's degrees. And so Chancellor Schmidt, who is the chancellor at UW-Eau Claire, has said that he wants to bring some English majors to the branch campus. He wants to bring some business classes there. You know, they want to offer four-year degrees, and even possibly, I've heard some discussion about three-year degrees. I mean, the idea is to... These two-year campuses are known as kind of the gateway to the UW system for people that are generally non-traditional students, people that work. And if they can get them through quicker, the idea is that it'll be more attractive.
And often in the case of a merger, whether it's in the corporate world or education or nonprofits, mergers often lead to consolidation of positions and functions, and so sometimes loss of jobs. Was that brought up by anyone who's involved in these discussions?
It was. President Cross, when he first announced his decision to merge these, or his idea anyway, to merge the two systems, and also we're not even talking about UW Extension, of which Wisconsin Public Radio is a part. UW Extension will move to UW System Administration, and your county cooperative extension offices, those will be overseen by UW Madison. So at first he said this was not intended for job losses, but later and since then he has said, of course there's going to be reductions, especially in administrative positions. It seems like they don't want to go after any faculty. They want students to get the same quality, but when you're merging two large organizations with pretty substantial sized administrative roles, it's bound to happen.
And Rich, as we wrap up, what kind of timeline are we looking for with these merger plans?
Well, the firm date is July 1st of 2018, so that's 7 months from now. And the Regents said that at each of their next six meetings, President Cross and others will basically do a progress report. So now that the plan is approved, they're going to get to work. It's going to be a lot of work. And there has been assurances that stakeholders will be involved in the process from this point on.
Well, Rich, thanks so much for bringing us up to speed.
My pleasure.
Rich Kramer is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Eau Claire. He joined us to talk about the UW Board of Regents decision to merge two-year campuses in the state with larger four-year schools in the University of Wisconsin system. As Rich said, Wisconsin Public Radio is currently part of UW Extension.
Right now, terrorist attacks involving vehicles can be tough to predict and to stop once they're in progress. But after deadly vehicle attacks in Barcelona, Berlin, Nice, and most recently New York, the bollard is being looked at as a possible solution.
The short, sturdy barriers protect pedestrians, and our next guest says they still make cities feel open and inviting.
Henry Grabar is a staff writer for Slate magazine. He wrote a recent piece on the use of bollards in cities around the world. Henry, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, this is a new word to me and probably a lot of people. What is a bollard?
Sure. A bollard is just a post. You may not know the word, but I'm sure you have seen bollards. They are, once you start paying attention to them, ubiquitous in the urban environment. You will see them outside gas stations. You will see them on sidewalks. You will see them at loading docks. They are these little metal posts that are designed to tell cars where not to park or not to drive.
And before some of the recent terrorist vehicle attacks, these were not seen as an anti-terrorist device, right? They were just a kind of a traffic safety thing.
Yeah, they've been used in both ways. I think there's a when you're telling people where not to drive, there's the metal post is intended to dissuade people, even if in many cases these posts are not strong enough to actually resist the strength of a car. So yeah, they've typically been used as sort of loose guidelines to tell drivers where not to park or drive. And in the last 30 years, as we've seen this rise, and especially in the last 5 years of vehicle-driven terrorist attacks, they've been fortified. And now they are used actually to prevent drivers from accessing sidewalks or busy streets.
And how commonly are they used that way?
Well, you see it all the time. And in particular, in dense American cities and in Europe, they've become very common as well. We don't have that many pedestrianized areas of American cities. So there is, to some extent, a limit on their use in that sense, but they are becoming more and more common. And as I said, it's really just in the last 5 years that I think that security officials have become really cognizant of the risks of terrorism from vehicles. So now if you look at New York, you look at Times Square, where a guy drove his car five blocks down the sidewalk earlier this year. Times Square now has bollards protecting all its pedestrian spaces, and there's actually a row of these metal posts that stopped that car earlier this year. So I think that you're going to see them rolled out more and more. Washington, D.C. has an amazingly intricate network of bollards and has for years around Capitol Hill as well.
And you write that a lot of times when there's a security measure worked into urban design, it's ugly, it closes off the city. And you write that bollards don't necessarily have to be that way.
Yeah, so there's this knee-jerk reaction, which is we need to protect this space, even sometimes if that means, you know, destroying it. Destroying the bike path to save it is sort of what happened in New York after the terrorist attack a few weeks ago on the Hudson River bike path, in which 7 or 8 people were killed. And the result of that was the state DOT laying down these gigantic concrete jersey barriers at diagonals across what is the busiest bike path in the nation's largest city, used by tens of thousands of people every day. And they sort of made it unusable through this, you know, in an effort to protect the people who were using it. And I don't think it needs to be that way. I mean, that's sort of the knee-jerk response, is roll out the most intense, the largest concrete barrier you can find. You see it outside Trump Tower in New York, too, where they'll park dump trucks full of sand to try and keep the building safe from whatever might come from the street. But it doesn't need to be that way. I mean, you look at some of the more intricate design solutions that have emerged around Wall Street, for example. They've got these really nicely designed bollards. And especially, as I said, in Europe, where you look at these pedestrianized city centers, where coming up with a solution has actually been a part of the design process from the start. And they've come up with really elegant ways to allow you to access these pedestrian car-free spaces without feeling like you are behind the walls of a highly securitized space.
We're talking to Henry Grabar from Slate magazine, looking at bollards, a way to try to prevent terrorist attacks with vehicles and otherwise prevent cars from driving in the wrong places where pedestrians are. Henry, talk about some of those more creative ways of doing this where you're walking maybe right by a security device and not know that it's there for that.
Yeah, sure. So one of the ones I like is the display that's set up at the New York Stock Exchange, which are these sort of crystalline bronze bollard shapes. They're called no-go, and they're really elegant, and they don't look sturdy because they have this sort of fine metal finish on them that almost makes them look like design objects. But of course, underneath that is a big steel pole that's embedded several feet into the ground, and would prevent a car from making any headway should a car head towards one of those. But when you're on the street, you get the sense that this is a design object, and it also it has a double function as a bench, and people use it to sit on. So you have this situation where in securing the space, they've not only secured it in a way that does not make people hyper-cognizant of the risk of terrorism, but they also have created a genuine public space where people can sit and sort of take a breather from their walk. So that's good, and I think the other thing is to come back to the first point I made, that you don't want people to feel, when they're accessing public space at the center of a city, you don't want them to be thinking all the time about the risk of a terrorist attack. So if there's a way to protect people from these incidents that does not feel like it's beating them over the head with the risk, I think that we should do our best to implement those solutions.
Are these also being used in kind of a temporary way where, okay, it's the weekly big farmers market in the street or the block party or the festival where we have a creative use of temporary bollards that can still provide effective protection?
Yeah, for sure. So I think one of the important moments in the history of bollards in the United States is comes when this old man runs his car through the Santa Monica Farmers Market in Los Angeles, and that was in 2003. So that was sort of before people got really aware of the risks of terrorist attacks from vehicles. But the result was to sort of find a way of making this space secure from this type of incident. And that you can see that executed every time there's a sort of temporary festival. And I spoke earlier about the crystalline no-go bollards outside the Stock Exchange, but this does not need to be high design. You can see in New York or in Montreal, for example, a friend of mine was at a street fair recently where they just plopped down some big slabs of concrete down there at the edge of the fair. And it was clear that they were, going to stop vehicles should a car decide to try and turn down that street, but that B, even though they were just these really simple, undesigned blocks of concrete, they also functioned as these really nice benches where people were just sitting and hanging out. So those can be picked up and removed at a moment's notice, and they have the effect of doubling again as this sort of added benefit urban design element.
One concern I've seen about the use of bollards is, okay, they prevent accidents like the one in Santa Monica. They might keep out a terrorist vehicle attack. They might also block an ambulance or other first responder if it needs to get into this area. Is that something that is solvable?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's always the concern whenever you have any pedestrianized space about how services are going to access it. And I would say the ambulance is the foremost concern, but obviously police too. And then, everything else, like garbage trucks and delivery vans, and there is, we do need vehicles to be able to access most space in the city at some point or another, because the economy hinges on those deliveries and pickups and whatnot. And there is a solution for that. I mean, anytime you have a street full of people, you're going to need to take extreme care when an ambulance or a police officer needs to access that space in a vehicle. You need to make sure that everyone is getting out of the way and not obviously being run over. But with respect to the bollards, when these are implemented as permanent solutions, there's often a way of raising or lowering them or detaching them. So this is not an insurmountable problem, and I know that this is one of the first things people think about, but it's something that the urban designers are thinking about as well. So they can either be detached or they can be raised or lowered. And often there's a sort of a back route access point where the vehicles can't have access to these pedestrianized spaces. So I think if you're concerned about that, that's a valid concern and it needs to be addressed, but it certainly shouldn't be a deal-breaker to try and creating a pedestrianized space.
A nagging thought at the back of my mind here, Henry, is that it sounds like we've put a lot more thought into how vehicles get around in our city and not as much into how pedestrians get around. Is that a fair assessment of how most cities, maybe especially in the United States, have worked?
Oh, for sure. I think about this all the time because you think about these beautiful streets that people really value. Like in New York, we've got this sort of grand boulevard called Eastern Parkway, which has these two medians of trees on either side, and people always think of it as a great street, but it also has eight lanes of traffic running down the center of it. And as people try and use these medians on either side, every time they cross the street, they have to sort of navigate this perilous environment of turning vehicles. And the truth is that most of these streets were designed to be used by horses and carriages and not by automobiles, and certainly not by automobiles going 45 miles an hour. So I think there is an extent to which we need to say that this whole urban environment has been taken over by vehicle priority, and it is time to take some of that back.
We'll leave it there for now. Henry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course.
That was Henry Grabar, staff writer for Slate Magazine, talking to us about how these bollards are being used to protect pedestrians from accidents or terrorist attacks involving vehicles. First on this edition of Food Friday, cooking is a family endeavor for celebrated chef Jacques Pepin and his granddaughter. They have a new cookbook out. It's called A Grandfather's Lessons in the Kitchen with Shori, and it's filled with family recipes that are unique and accessible for cooks of all ages.
Jacques Pepin joins us now along with his granddaughter Shori. Jacques and Shori, bienvenue à Central Time.
Oh, merci beaucoup.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
So, Jacques, we'll start with you. Why did you want to write a cookbook of recipes that you've made along with your granddaughter?
Well, it started, not long after she was born. She started being in the kitchen with me, helping. She had a little box standing on top and giving me things and tasting food for me. Of course, now she's taller than I am, but... Actually, we decided to do a series of little tape together doing recipe that we like to do. She loved chocolate or any type of dessert. And we didn't even want to do a book. And Claudine, my daughter, Shore's mother, said, oh, you got to do a book with that. So we did that little book. And actually, in the book, there is about 70 recipes, but there is 36 of those recipes are DVD, you know, where you can access. If you want to know how it's done, then you can see Shore and I making the recipe. You know.
Yes, so you just go online on Sur la Table, and there are the sets of videos that we made for some of the recipes.
You can see that Shore has a different accent than me because I live in Connecticut and she lives in Rhode Island.
Yes, we could hear that Connecticut accent.
Yeah, right.
Shore, what are some of your earliest cooking memories?
Well, I've been eating with my grandfather and my parents my whole life, all this good food. But I think I started really cooking with him when I was about 6 or 7. It was for the Essential Pépin series, and I did stand on a box.
And Shore, you know, it's funny when you know someone who's famous, but you know them from an early age, you don't necessarily realize that they are well known and that they are well respected. Do you remember when you figured out, hey, I think Pepi is maybe a bigger deal than I thought?
Honestly, I don't think I've really figured it out yet. When I was younger, I just thought of him as my grandfather, and people were always asking me what was it like to have him as my grandfather, and I was like, what do you mean? You know, he's my grandfather. So it's hard to take in that people think of him in that way.
And Jacques, yes. I want to get into the cookbook, A Grandfather's Lessons, and going through the recipes. I mean, from the title, some of them sound like they're going to be fancy and complicated. These all seem doable, even for someone like me. Was that what you were shooting for in this cookbook?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I always like to simplify food. I've done it. I think this is book number 32 for me. So, but I even simplify it further with this. I wanted her to be able to do it. I wanted her to have fun. And, you know, with a kid, it starts, well, when she was very tiny, going to the garden, take her to the garden. And her father is a chef as well, so they have a big garden. Go get me some tarragon. No, this is chive. No, this is parsley. And then even going to the market with me, you know. And I tell her, go get me some pear. Make sure, smell them, make sure they are ripe or whatever. So the kid, you know, have to handle, touch the food, and be with in the kitchen with you just for fun. And, you know, in the cooking together, we bring a lot of other things in there. For example, you know, we'd have a tomato. I say, well, is a tomato a fruit or a vegetable? Where does it come from? Or whatever. Or then I ask her, give me 3 tablespoons of butter. How many tablespoons you have in that stick? How many stick in a pound? How many tablespoons in that glass of milk? So we bring mathematics in it. We bring all kind of things through food, you know.
So Jacques, I think one of the things that is different between France and the U.S. is that there is a long tradition of home cooking in France that continues to this day. Certainly some convenience foods have been introduced, but I think there's a fair number of American parents who would like to get in the kitchen with their kids, but they don't actually feel like they have the skills to pass along. Do you think this book would be good for them, too?
Yes, absolutely. You know, it can go. I mean, look, for example, I do a chicken there. I can, of course, home, I roast a chicken most of the time, but I wanted to show her. We were at the market and there was nice chicken coming out of the rotisserie. I said, let's get a chicken. I'll show you something. I bought some nice Boston lettuce. I love Boston lettuce. Any lettuce would do. I spread them on a large tray. And then with a shear, we cut the chicken. And then in the skillet, I put some olive oil to a bit of a chopped onion or shallot, some garlic. We spread that on top of the cut chicken, a bit of lemon juice. And all of a sudden you make it your own, you know, so you transform it. We did another dish like that. I said, you want to do a cake for your mother for her birthday? I want to show you how to do it. So we buy a nice quality pound cake and a little jar of raspberry preserve. We heat the raspberry preserve in the microwave. I trim the pound cake all around. We put the trimming in the food processor to make crumbs. And then with two little pieces of wood, actually I use 2 ribs of celery now, one on each side of the cake. I can put the knife flat and show her how to slice the cake. It's not that easy, but that make a guide. And then we put jam on top of it. We put back the crumbs and we have a beautiful little cake. I mean, anyone can do that.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Jacques Pepin and his granddaughter, Shori. Their new book is A Grandfather's Lessons in the Kitchen with Shori. I want to get into some of the recipes you've shared with us. Let's start with, these look wonderful in the picture, the cottage cheese pancakes. Can you tell us the story behind these, Jacques?
Behind that my wife who makes cottage cheese pancake, and Shori was there, and she said, oh, I love those pancakes. I said, okay, well, we're going to do a recipe then. And she wanted to serve it with blueberry. She loves blueberry. I think we put a little bit of apricot preserve with that, and they are very easy. They are done in a few minutes. Shori, have you done them home by themselves?
Yeah, we have actually done them once or twice. I really like having them for breakfast.
Good.
What does the cottage cheese add to the pancakes?
Well, moisture, a little bit of a different taste, you know, texture as well as moisture, and it's kind of light and relatively not too caloric, you know.
And you can actually see that recipe for the cottage cheese pancakes over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Shori, you know, you're growing up in the United States. There are kids who don't eat everything that comes to the table that adults are eating. They're eating fish sticks and chicken fingers and plain spaghetti. But you really grew up eating everything. And are you glad you did?
I mean, when I was growing up, there was no other option to not eat what they put in front of you. So my parents said, this is what we're having for dinner. I never had the idea to ask for something else. So that's, I think, is a big reason why I didn't grow up picky. And I'm definitely glad that I haven't grown up that way.
But now that you're grown up, is there any option?
No, there's not.
Oh, but that said, there are recipes for spaghetti and hamburgers,
sure,
and mac and cheese, a lot of the basic things we think of as kid foods you've got versions of in the cookbook, Jacques.
Yes, we even have a curly dog.
That's right. That looked great.
I, I used to work for Howard Johnson many, many years ago. I was in the test kitchen, so we used to produce at the commissary tons of hot dog, you know. So I used to fool around with them, putting them in soup or with sauerkraut or with all kind of thing. And one day, I don't know why we came out with that idea of cutting them so they kind of curl up. So you know, some of the recipe are fun, but I mean, we did a little pickling things to put on top, and you add that on half a hamburger bun, and it's a great recipe. It's fun.
We're talking with Jacques Pépin and his granddaughter, Shori, about cooking in the kitchen as a family. They have a new book out right now. It's called A Grandfather's Lessons in the Kitchen with Shori.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What cooking questions do you have for Chef Pépin? If you cook with your kids or your grandchildren, how did you get them interested in the kitchen? Or maybe you're looking for some advice on how to get cooking as a family. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post and find some of the recipes we're talking about on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll be back with Jacques and Shori in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're continuing our conversation on this week's Food Friday with Chef Jacques Pépin and his granddaughter, Shori. They're with us to talk about tradition and cooking through the generations. And they have a new cookbook out called A Grandfather's Lessons in the Kitchen with Shori. In it, they share family recipes and stories.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are some of your favorite recipes to cook with your kids or grandchildren, or that you remember cooking when you were growing up with your parents or your grandparents? What advice would you like to get from our guests on cooking on particular dishes or on cooking as a family? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or find some recipes from our guests on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And Jacques and Shori, let's talk about your tomato soup recipe. And Jacques, the way you introduce it, it sounds like tomato soup is a base that you can turn into just about anything you want.
Yes, actually, you know, it's a tomato soup, but you can make a sauce for pasta with it. You know, you can add it to a stew. You can do all kind of things. You can serve it hot. You can serve it cold. You can serve it lukewarm. You can serve it with the cream or without the cream. You can serve it with herb from the garden. Very often, if we have, of course, on not only tarragon, but certainly basil, we would put that on top. Yes, so it's a kind of very versatile recipe.
And is that a favorite of yours, Shori?
I love tomato soup. I've grown up eating it. So, yeah, this really tastes like home.
Let's bring on a caller now. Tim is with us in Madison. Tim, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Tim?
Well, I just used to watch the Essential Pépin show all the time, you know, on PBS. And I just love to watch this young granddaughter interact with her grandfather. It was especially enjoyable. And I love the chocolate, as you mentioned before. I can remember those series, but I just was curious to know from each of them if they have any particular memory doing that series together, if anything, you know, stands out for them.
Well, I remember you step on that little box too, and we had chocolate, and I said, test it. You put your finger through, I push your finger in it. Then after you add it on your face, on your lip. I don't do that with you anymore.
No, I remember I had chocolate on my face like the entire episode, and I watched it just recently, actually, and I was like, what was I thinking? Why didn't anyone get that off of my face?
Yeah. But you know, okay, 6 years ago, that's 6-7 years ago, and for me, who passed 80 years old, it's not that long ago, but for you, it's half of your life, right?
Yeah.
And did you have favorites of what you made on that show?
Do you?
I actually really liked that recipe with the graham crackers and the chocolate on the inside.
Graham cracker, yes.
That was probably one of my favorites.
Thanks for that call, Tim. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for Jacques and Shori. And next we have Mary Beth calling from New Berlin. Hi, Mary Beth.
Hi there. I wanted to thank Jacques for something that I learned while watching one of his shows that has just become a family favorite for us. He made a swan out of a melon, and then put cut fruit in it. And it's just such an elegant presentation for fruit. And I do that so often, and my family loves it. Thank you so much.
Oh, good. Well, thank you very much. It's always rewarding for me to have, you know, people should look at a recipe and try to do it just the way it is, at least the first time. If it comes out good, you're likely to do it again. Second time, you take a faster look. By the third, fourth time, you, quote, improve the recipe. You want more tomato in it, or you want to cook it shorter, or whatever. And a year later, you don't remember where it come from, and it has become your own recipe. You kind of massage it to your sense of taste, to your sense of aesthetic. And I think it's something which is gratifying to me when people do that.
Thanks so much for that call, Mary Beth. And Jacques, I want to ask you a question. There's a photo at the beginning of the cookbook, and you and Shori are in the kitchen together, and you are dipping a balloon in chocolate. And
yes.
I want to know what you're doing there.
Well, we dip the... You want to explain that? Okay.
So we melt down the chocolate in the microwave, and you have to make sure to not scorch the chocolate. You can't do it over 40 seconds. And then you take the balloons and you blow them up and you sort of roll them in the chocolate. And then you put them in the fridge.
Inflated balloon.
Right.
Inflated
balloons.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. And you roll them in the chocolate. You put them in the fridge and let the chocolate harden. And then afterwards, you can pop the balloons to take them out. And you have this beautiful chocolate goblet that you can put mousse or whipped cream or something. And it's a really nice presentation.
Strawberry, raspberry.
Yes, fruit.
Whipped cream.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say I've done a lot of these Food Friday segments. This is the first time I've seen a recipe include 4 latex balloons.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yes.
And I wanted
you don't put it... No, don't put any mashed potato in it.
No, no.
No.
Well, speaking of chocolate, one of the recipes you shared with us, I want to make sure we get into. We've got this on the Ideas Network Facebook page, the chocolate, nut, and fruit treats recipe. Jacques, tell us about that one.
Yes, this is very, very easy. Again, you melt your chocolate in the microwave oven, and you take those tiny little paper cup, you know, about 3-4 tablespoons big, it doesn't really matter. And then you pour about 2 tablespoons of the value of melted chocolate in it, and before it hardens, then you garnish the top. You embed into the soft chocolate, you embed any type of nuts you want, walnut, hazelnut, almond,
fruit.
You know, pistachio, and then a fresh fruit, you cut pieces, dry fruit, dry cranberry or whatever, even a little piece of mint, you know, we put, and then you put that in the refrigerator 15-20 minutes, it hardens, you remove the paper cup, and you have beautiful little dessert, which you would spend a fortune in a restaurant to have.
We are talking with Jacques Pépin and his granddaughter, Shori. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And I want to point out something that's in this cookbook. Very simple recipe, but a very French recipe to me, which is radishes with butter. And whenever I have radishes with butter, people here look at me a little funny. What is so great about radishes with butter? Shori, why don't you take that one?
Well, I think that since radishes have a really strong flavor, obviously they're kind of spicy, the butter sort of complements that. And I think that if you put like butter and salt on it, it's just the flavors, they go really well together. So
yeah, with a good baguette, though.
Yes.
Yes. We also, I'm sure you have seen, instruction on folding napkin, on setting up the table. We have instruction on table manner, which Shori loved to do because I was the guinea pig. And she told me, don't slouch, don't put your elbow on the table, don't speak with your mouth full, don't interrupt me, bring the spoon to your mouth, so forth. So
no
she had
slurping.
A good time correcting me. Yes, right.
So Shori, what do you recommend to kids who might want to start cooking but really don't know where to start, and maybe their parents don't know where to start?
Well, I think that if you want to start cooking as a kid or as an adult, you should just find like something that you enjoy eating and find a simple recipe for it and then just try and make it. I mean, there's not much that can go wrong. My friends and I, we sometimes try and make food together, and it's usually more about the process of actually making the food instead of the outcome, because it's not always so great.
Yeah, the process also of going to the garden if you have one, and even if you don't have one, going to the market, bring the kid to the market, make them pick up the strawberry, the fruit, and so forth. I mean, frankly, you know, at my age, how do you communicate to a kid who's 12 years old? She's very fast with her iPad and iPhone, much faster than me. But then at least we have a common ground here. We can talk and eventually, you know, talking in the kitchen, and we talk around the table, and that's, I think, very important. So the kid has to get involved from day one. I don't think I ever made the baby food for Claudine when she was small. We just started not a cuisiner. At the time, it was a blender, yes, starting. So anything we ate, I put in the blender, short of not to season. And she would have that as a puree. So meaning that by the time the kid is 8 years old, if you do, spaghetti and cream sauce, well, they know that taste because they probably had it as a puree when they were small, you know.
And Shori, my kids are about your age, and they're not fussy eaters, but there's a lot of stuff in the book that I don't think they would eat if I put it in front of them. Do you encounter that as you meet your peers? They look at what you're eating and they're like, what? What is that?
I think I actually have a really good group of friends. Okay. They're all very diverse, but in my school, there are probably many people who are not as open to new ideas and unfamiliar foods like that. So, yeah, I understand.
And Jacques, there are some really lovely little line drawings, besides wonderful photos, in this book. And I understand that those are yours.
Yes, not only the drawing. You can see on the first open page, I have the drawing of one menu that I did, and Shori did the other one. So after 51 years of marriage, I have 12 book of menu. This way, you know, that we've done when people come at home. My whole life, you know, is on this. I can see my mother signing in there, my two brothers. I can tell you what Claudine, my daughter, had for her fifth birthday. So this is the habit that we do at the house that, Shori, you do at your house also now.
Yeah.
And you do the drawing.
I think we have one book and then one in progress. So it's a little bit of a newer tradition in our house right now. But yeah.
Wow. So it's like a historical family scrapbook of meals.
Yes, and you don't even have to do a drawing. Take a book and record, you know, the holiday, certainly the birthday, all of that type of stuff, when special guests come. You can also look at them and say, those people had dinner here 3 years ago, what did we serve them? So you don't serve the same thing. Or maybe you serve the same thing.
Maybe they really liked it and they want the same thing.
So, Shori, as we wrap up, if you had to make something for a big party this weekend, what would be your go-to dish in our last few moments?
I would definitely make, like, just roast chicken and a salad. It's simple, it's clean, and almost everyone likes it. I've never met a person who doesn't like roast chicken, so.
And Jacques, what are you going to be making whenever you get back home to Madison, Connecticut?
Ooh, fish, probably. I mean, the Arctic char for me with a fresh tomato. That's very good. My wife loves fish, so, yeah, that type of thing.
Well, Jacques, Shori, merci beaucoup. We really enjoyed having you with us.
Merci bien.
Merci.
Merci. Merci. Au revoir. A bientôt, j'espère. That was Jacques Pépin and his granddaughter, Shori. Their new book is A Grandfather's Lessons in the Kitchen with Shori.
And you can find three of the recipes from that cookbook and try making it at home. They're all pretty easy and approachable. What do we have? The pancakes?
We have cottage cheese
tomato
pancakes.
Soup.
Tomato soup and
chocolate fruit
nut.
And nuts.
Yes.
Yeah. So you can find that all on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And if you have a favorite Jacques Pépin memory, you can share it there as well. Again, that's on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. A lot of people in Wanakee were worried about a gas leak earlier this week and called the police and fire departments to make a report. This according to the Wisconsin State Journal.
There was a strong smell in the air, which made people think of natural gas. There were reports that it smelled like melted plastic or maybe burnt popcorn.
It wasn't any of those things. We're here in Wisconsin. Take a few moments to think about what the mystery smell might have been.
That's right. It was cow manure spread on a local farmer's field.
Now, I find this to be, this is obviously something you smell a lot in Wisconsin. And growing up in Michigan, I was across the dirt road from cows, dairy cows. This is a common smell. I would think you could pick this out pretty easily in Wisconsin.
I would think so, too. And especially that it wouldn't be something unnatural like plastic.
Right. Right. And, you know, even in the middle of a city without, you know, I'm not now currently living mm-hmm. across the street from cows, but when it's applied, I think the Parks Department yep. does sometimes, or the field just outside of town, it's all the way the wind is going.
Well, and that's very true, because when I started college in Champaign, Illinois, our dorm was across from the agricultural fields. It was also the only one with air conditioning. I think there was a connection, because some days you really had to close those windows.
It's the air from the dairy here on Central Time.
I've been over there, hey, smelled that dairy air, hey. Once a bottle clear, hey, thought I saw a bear, hey. I had a creep up at State Fair, hey, I've been over there. I've been to Edgerton, Darlington, Middleton, Hubbleton, Hub City, Cuba City, Genoa City, Ashburn, Ashland, Packwaukee, Pewaukee, Waukesha, Conemaugh, Wapak, Milwaukee, Wausau, Wauwatosa, Wapak.